Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What separates U.S. presidents from the also-rans? In recent decades, the country's biggest elections tend to produce two inevitable winners every time: the early frontrunner who garners so much media and voter attention, and the person who actually wins the election months later. Why are they almost never the same person? Beyond the ideal combination of leadership skills, charisma, and policy positions in a particular candidate, my guest today says winning requires a nimble, well-disciplined campaign staff and an understanding that strategy must be very different depending on whether the person is running as an incumbent, successor, or challenger. Samuel L. Popkin is professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He served as a polling and strategy consultant to the Carter, McGovern, Clinton, and Gore campaigns. His new book is called The Candidate: What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Sam, welcome to Think.
Thank you. And I would just like to add that before going to UC San Diego, I was also a professor at the University of Texas.
Wonderful. Well, welcome, welcome back home.
Welcome, Horns.
How do a candidate's challenges differ depending on whether that person is the incumbent, the successor, or the challenger?
What motivated me to write the book, Chris, was trying to understand what standards to apply to the painful experience of being part of the Gore campaign. And that's when I realized how understanding the differences is the beginning of developing a decent strategy. And this year we have an incumbent and a challenger, and nothing could be more different. I like to think of the incumbent's campaign like a battleship. It moves very slowly and it makes big waves. The challenger's campaign is more like a speedboat, or if you will, a PT boat. It can move very fast, it can change course very quickly, and it relies more on attacks than on defenses if it's done well.
And I'm mixing up metaphors here, but successors, you say, have the toughest road to hoe. Why is that?
Well, when you've been in the national limelight for 8 years in the White House, or 4 years, you have this feeling that everybody already knows you because you've been out there so much. But in fact, people are very confused about what you are. Are you an appendix? Are you a lapdog? Are you a cheerleader? What do you stand for? How much of it did you mean when you did the automatic total agreement most of the time with the president?
And of course, Al Gore was in a particularly tough spot because President Clinton had been humiliated by the Monica Lewinsky sex scandal.
Well, I agree, but I think actually Vice President Bush in 88 was in a much more difficult situation. He was under the shadow of a possible indictment over the Contras. Nobody said Al Gore was involved with Monica Lewinsky. Mm. All he did was defend the president. I think Al could have had it much easier.
So why did George H.W. Bush manage to succeed where Gore failed?
First of all, he started planning in 1984 how to build a team and understood that the key to his campaign was never allowing distance to develop between him and President Reagan so that he would be a natural policy successor in many ways. And it's never easy. He got lots of challenges, but he let the convention, when he became the nominee and the new leader of the party, the time of separation. Al thought he should do it immediately by disowning the president he'd been defending.
Then, though, when it was time to run for a second term, Bush 41 faltered, in part, you say, because he'd failed to plan for showdowns over things like the budget and entitlement programs.
I was very flattered when a liberal friend said to me that he felt sympathy for President Bush when reading about 92. It was an extraordinarily difficult situation. President Reagan slashed taxes, and the deficit soared, and there were problems with interest rates. And all the young Turks in the Bush White House said, well, first we cut taxes, and now step two will be to cut the size of government. And the Democrats controlled the Congress, and that wasn't going to happen. And there was internecine warfare, and he could never figure out what is the right time to bite a bullet and take a big hit.
And candidates, no matter whether they are successor, challenger, or incumbent, also have to decide how to relate to their own parties. Can you talk a little bit about how those decisions are made?
It's one of the key parts of the strategy. Many people in the media like to see this as a prize fight, mano a mano, Hillary versus Barack, or Obama versus McCain. But the party matters more than people might realize. This is Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney against President Obama. Earlier, it was similar situations when Vice President Bush, for example, could run against Tip O'Neill as well as Mike Dukakis, or the liberal approach to crime instead of a tougher approach when people were so worried about crime. What you do, especially when you're president, to force the candidate who's an outsider to have to take positions, say, with the Tea Party or with the Democratic Party's left, the way Walter Mondale did, are critical to making it hard on the challenger.
Sometimes, this is really interesting, there are calculated fights picked by challengers. And John McCain in 2008 is a good example, openly criticizing the Bush administration's policies on torture in the Iraq War.
Yes, you have to show that you're your own person. And that was one he was strongly identified with for so long as a prisoner. It was a way to remind people he was a prisoner. It came from his heart. So it was easy to convey how much it meant to him, and it was a way of letting people know he's his own person, not just a tool of the party.
So you write that a candidate has essentially three jobs. They have to create a public identity or a brand, develop a vision for the future, and preside over his or her campaign. Let's start with the first one. What does it take to create a public identity that people who will be voting can feel connected to?
You know, I think of how much easier it is to be the Queen of England or even Princess Diana. The rules change very slowly, and there's 50 people to tell you when to curtsy, where to have tea, who to knight, what to do. But when you're candidates, you can be as different as Ronald Reagan from Hollywood or Jimmy Carter from Plains, Georgia, or even look at the two presidents Bush and how differently they portrayed themselves. W was very much the home guy from Midland, Odessa, who wore his boots and walked and talked. He was a baseball team owner from Texas, mm-hmm. with a real Texas identity. And you have to have an identity that people can feel represents them and the country.
And you write about this four-quadrant message box that campaigns use in order to sort of decide how to communicate and figure what they are likely to face from their opponents.
You know, you want to keep it very simple. And like a football team, if I may use a Cowboys analogy.
Sure.
You start a game. You know what you want to do, and you know what you want to stop the other team from doing. And you know how they're going to try and stop you. And you know how they're going to try and do things against you. And you want to be prepared. And it's, keeping it simple, though, in a campaign requires enormous work in advance so you're prepared for the attacks that are going to come on you. And that's hard. When you have the ego to run for president, somebody has to be able to say to you, they're not going to believe all those things they believed in Arkansas or Texas. Or they're going to ask you tougher questions, and here's what you've got to be ready for. And that's very hard when you've claimed you're already fit to be the leader of the biggest country in the world.
Yeah, the ego question is fascinating because, as you rightly point out here, you can't be all that humble if you believe yourself worthy of running for the nation's highest office. And yet, people want a sense that the candidate asking for their vote is, in fact, humble.
You know, when I wrote my acknowledgement, and that's, you really hit something very critical there, Chris. When I wrote my acknowledgements, I wanted to say writing the book humbled me, and then I realized I couldn't. I couldn't say that because I quote Ben Franklin as saying, humility is an important virtue. I never had it, but I learned how to fake it. And learning how to act humble, whether you are or not, means learning enough about people to listen to them and to know what they're going to ask you. And I think it's very important. The difference between General MacArthur and General Eisenhower was Eisenhower was willing to sit down and let ordinary people ask him what he would have considered very simple, trivial questions and patiently answer them. MacArthur was above all that and acted like Caesar.
And that was an interesting difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in the 2008 primaries. You saw Mrs. Clinton as being much more concerned with showing that she was strong enough to be president.
Yes. And there's an irony to this because she was probably considered the strongest person in the party. Mm-hmm. And trying to prove she was as tough as Margaret Thatcher, as opposed to that she could also listen. She actually is, by the way, an extraordinarily good, warm person who just never knew how to end a conversation because she would get so deep. If she had gotten more homey earlier in Iowa, she might well have been our president today. There's an irony when an African-American raised in Indonesia and Hawaii looks more in tune with the people of Iowa than a Methodist from Illinois.
It's also interesting because, you know, 3.5 years in, many people don't perceive President Obama to be particularly well connected to the average voter.
It's hard to look connected when everything isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
President Reagan didn't look as connected in 83 or early 84 before things started to click. Being connected means delivering.
So, Sam, can you train that into a candidate? I mean, can the most brilliant staff in America really make someone into a person that he or she is not naturally?
A lot less than people think.
Mm-hmm.
A lot less. You know, there's this image of you can turn anybody into the ideal candidate. I did computer work very early in my career, and Eugene Burdick even wrote a book about the day by long before this when the computers would pick the perfect candidate. Well, you can't change people much. You can, if they don't have the intellectual energy to learn, and if they don't have a core, you can only help them when they have a core to express it and know how far to go and when with their beliefs.
So I take it you have to be careful in instructing candidates to portray this sort of humility. You don't want them to seem disingenuous.
You can't. It's very tricky. And humility is a tough one because you're going to hear the same question 50 times. You're going to hear it from really powerful fundraisers who know the depths of an oil issue or a civil rights issue. You're going to hear it from local activists who only heard, you know, what was on Fox or CNN or NPR that day. And you have to be able to give answers to both groups that don't contradict.
Samuel L. Popkin is my guest. He's professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and a one-time consultant to the Carter, McGovern, Clinton, and Gore campaigns. His new book is called The Candidate: What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the line now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Samuel L. Popkin is my guest. He's professor of political science at UC San Diego and a former consultant to the Carter, McGovern, Clinton, and Gore campaigns. His new book is called The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Our telephone number, if you've got a question, is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Sam, for anyone who wasn't aware of it before, one thing this book really points out is that running for president is not for the faint of heart. And on both sides, even with the candidates that sort of flamed out over time, you give us some examples of the sorts of everyday challenges they have and the kinds of things they have to do successfully every single day just to stay in the race.
It's you nailed it, Chris. It's extremely difficult. We think of this as, becoming the biggest winner in the world. Well, either Mitt Romney or Barack Obama is going to become the biggest loser in the world soon. And nobody ever gets over losing at this point. And anybody who's ever run, as former Senator Bob Kerrey said, never loses that desire to give a State of the Union.
What does it take to develop a vision for the future that is not only reflective of what the candidate actually wants, but that will once again connect with the broad cross-section of American voters that you need to win an election?
Well, that is almost another book. You've asked, you can hear my stumbles for the first time today, a really good vision for the future fits with the hopes and dreams of the time, and it must be consistent with your character or your political past so that it doesn't look like cheap talk. I mean, a Democrat cannot run for president saying, I'm going to slash taxes 80% and end health care.
Yeah.
A Republican can't say, I'm going to run for president and increase a number of programs that Democrats love and Republicans have always opposed. You must be credible, and you must prove that it's consistent so that it's not just cheap talk.
Talk about, you say the ideal challenger is what you call an experienced virgin. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is, of course, a total contradiction. But there are two things we want in a challenger. We want somebody who's pure, who never compromises their values, who always does what they say. And yet we want somebody who can wade into Washington, get things done, and stay clean. It's not easy. It's impossible. But people keep dreaming the dream.
And there are essentially three types of challengers. There are senators, there are governors, and heroes, which is a sort of different category. Can you tell us a bit about the pros and cons of finding oneself in any one of those three positions?
Well, you're in one, and you have to adapt to it.
Uh-huh.
If you're a governor, your teamwork will be based on knowing a lot about jobs, management, and bureaucracy, and likely you will know very little about defense and foreign policy, and you're going to have to adapt.
Yeah.
If you're a senator, your staff is brilliant at the fine print and dealing with the head of the union, Grover Norquist, the head of the National Association of Small Businessmen, but not likely to know much about how to work in the small towns of America the way a governor's staff might, who can talk like a governor. And each of them has to adapt. The heroes have the hardest time, and the most obvious recent example is former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who was endorsed in 2007 by Pat Robertson, Governor Rick Perry, Senator David Vitter. He set at the time a new record for fundraising. He was America's mayor. He was Time Magazine's Person of the Year. And he was so full of himself and so happy being a hero that he couldn't do things that weren't heroic, like talk about daily life and taxes, because those things are messy and dirty. They're not standing on top of the world and saying, you'll get Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak first with Julian in Dallas. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Chris. On the cover of today's New York Times, there's an article on an expose about what I would characterize as a hit piece planned by the chairman of TJ Ameritrade, the owner of the Chicago Cubs, on Obama for the fall election. And it's basically a storyboard for a minute short film about Reverend Wright, as if we hadn't heard enough of him. And I just wondered what the author thought about the implications of Citizens United and the first presidential election it will affect, and how a candidate can either be basically trashed or elevated by the fortunes of one man.
That's an interesting question, Julian. And in fact, right before this program began, we heard an NPR News update saying that the Romney campaign, at least on the face of it, is trying to distance itself from this activity that has been planted by this PAC.
Thank you for pointing that out, Chris. I was going to say the same thing. But whether they liked it or not, in either campaign, a hit piece would be disowned so that you could distance. But in this case, I think neither campaign knows right now whether that huge reminder about Reverend Wright helps or hurts. Huge, very large numbers of people do not like Reverend Wright, and many of them associate Barack Obama with African-American excesses, as they might put it. They're almost all committed already. Does raising that issue mobilize more people to support Obama, who might have sat out the election as semi-disappointed former supporters? Or does it help in some battleground states to bring some new people to former Governor Romney? I think that the damage of all these super PACs are these egos run wild. And in fact, I wish the money was in the hands of the candidates, not these super PACs. It is not good for the process, and it's like an arms race that is going to just cancel it out.
The other really interesting headline this week is about John Edwards, of course, sitting in court, and there are these allegations that he may have used campaign funds to try and hide the fact that he had a pregnant mistress during his own campaign. I'm curious about your views on opposition research and how that plays into the way campaigns strategize, and how many people you think within the Edwards campaign might have imagined that he would be caught while running.
I can't imagine very many people early on were capable of believing in him and imagining he would do something as appallingly dumb as having an affair with a woman with one of the dumbest pickup lines ever, and a woman that was so famous that Jay McInerney wrote a book about his drug-addled affair with her earlier. I mean, what it says to me is how amazingly fragile people become when they're putting their egos on the line, and the ego-stoking things they end up doing. I thought a lot lately about Senator Edwards building the 28,000-square-foot house after 2004, because many people know former Governor Romney bought a phenomenal piece of real estate in La Jolla, California, and he paid $12 million for an oceanfront lot and paid lobbyists to get permission to build 3,600 new feet underground to add to the house and an underground four-car garage. That is not something you should do when you're running for president. I don't understand where the lack of, maybe it doesn't matter, but I'm surprised.
So some of this would seem to come down to staff, which ultimately seems to be the crux of this book, that the people running the campaign have to have a unified vision, they have to get along with one another, and they have to be in a position to speak honestly to this candidate they're supporting.
I have to think that this was done impulsively by the Romney family before they had the new staff, and that they didn't listen carefully. Now, when you're running as a successful businessman, let's make it clear, you have different standards than if you're running as a Democratic man of the people.
Right.
So being rich is not a problem. having a beautiful house is not a problem. But the Swiss bank account that wasn't closed until 2010, the underground elevator, those were things that somebody should have pointed out to him.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Miles in Dallas. Hi, Miles.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to say that I'll say all the Republicans, whether it's all or not, it doesn't really matter. They're complaining that the president hasn't done anything that he promised to do. However, they do not, nobody mentions that the Republicans in Congress have en masse said, we aren't going to let him pass anything. What is the reason none of that has been brought forward? Please.
What do you think, Sam?
Well, that's the heart of the difference. First, every president is elected that has been elected in my lifetime has done less than they promised. So the glass is always half full, and the challenger's job is always to point out, you promised a full glass and it's only half full, and if I were president, it would be full. And the president has to say, without me, the glass would be empty. And it's the hard job now for the president is to make people understand. And it's much harder to say, it's not my fault, without looking like a whiner. Bill Clinton looked like a loser until he was able to veto some overreaching budget moves. It wasn't easy to pin it on the Congress, and there are chances coming up with whatever happens in the Supreme Court on health care, and there are chances with the promised budget showdown. But this is a really high-stakes poker game. President Truman and President Clinton and President Reagan played it well. President G.H.W. Bush played it very badly. And we don't know yet whether President Obama is set up, if he's setting things up and the Republicans are walking into a trap, or if he is unaware of what he has to have done already.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Don in Richardson. Hey, Don.
Hi. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. I'd like to ask your guest what he thinks, what his opinion is of the fact that the mass media from the very start of this Republican campaign has blacked out Ron Paul almost completely. It's as if they're afraid of him or something. Is that because he's a constitutionalist or because he's not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations or the Masonic Lodge or what?
I agree with you that Ron Paul gets less ink than votes. I'm not sure why, but it's clear that he doesn't fit into the typical partisan mold, and nobody is sure what to make in the press that I have met of this mixture of smart libertarian and economic positions that very few experts take seriously. Either he's a visionary or a quack on some positions, and I don't know how to judge, and I don't think most of the press does either.
Talk a little bit about internal divisions within campaigns. This was an issue in the Hillary Clinton campaign, also in the Al Gore campaign. And in the case of the Gore campaign, you say that staffers were essentially just looking at their lives beyond the time of the White House and almost just didn't focus enough, if I'm reading you correctly.
Yes, and I think you see the difference in the 2012 versus the 2008 Romney campaigns, too. In 2008, there were too many divisions in Governor Romney's campaign because he was talking to too many people and wasn't able to get everybody on the same page. And he learned how much harder it is to run a campaign than to be CEO of a bunch of big corporations. And he simplified his structure and put some very careful people in. But when things happen fast, like the attack on Richard Grenell, his gay and very, very able conservative foreign policy expert. It looks like divisions in the campaign led to Mr. Grinnell's resignation, and I'm sure that they certainly wish now that they'd kept him on.
Was the 2008 race particularly interesting for you to watch simply because there was no incumbent and no successor?
It was fascinating. It's one of the three times in the last 100 years we've had that. And McCain was in the incredibly difficult position. And frankly, if the crisis had, if the economic crisis had happened 6 months sooner, you would have had Romney versus Obama in 2008, and who knows what would have happened. Or Clinton. I actually would have been Clinton versus Romney, because Senator McCain was the acceptable lowest common denominator for people who weren't sure about Governor Romney and didn't like the others.
But you characterize Romney in this primary as being the only truly viable candidate. Why is that?
Well, that's in terms of having possible, having possibly what it takes to get to 50.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of Republicans would say, I'm crazy, because a true conservative, a true religious, moral conservative would then inflame the people and impassion them in a way that a business executive couldn't. But I thought of him as the one person with a chance to really get to 50. The way Clinton and Carter were border state moderate Democrats who could get away from the excesses of the 70s and 80s, Mitt Romney, between the Olympics, Bain Capital, and Massachusetts in 2009, and before, was planning perfectly to be president.
Samuel L. Popkin is my guest. He's professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and served as a consultant to the Carter, McGovern, Clinton, and Gore campaigns. His new book is called The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Samuel L. Popkin, professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and author of the new book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Sam, I want to talk a bit here about debates. We know that the GOP debate this year, there were a number of them, were instrumental in knocking out several candidates, including our governor, Rick Perry.
Yep.
History has shown us so many examples, though, of debates in which the candidate who won on substance did not necessarily come out ahead in the polls. And, of course, the most famous example is Nixon-Kennedy, 1960. Talk a little bit about what candidates think about and how they prepare to give the best possible debate performance.
It's well, In the main event that's coming up, it's much more difficult than it looks for the incumbent, because the incumbent has been surrounded for 4 years by people who never questioned their motives. And they think they know everything going on in America and the world. And in fact, they're like the emperor walking down the street naked in some ways, because nobody wants to be blunt or tough with them. Who needs to deal with them every day? And the challenger's big job is figuring out how to respectfully stand up as an alternative that can do better without insulting the commander-in-chief and the country's leader. You can't salute and give the finger at the same time. And the president, to me, the irony is always that every president realizes when they get there how much harder it is than they thought. And after 4 years, they know that the challenger is unprepared and unready and is saying silly, foolish, wrong things just like they did. But they can't believe that people will believe it again just the way they believed it when they said it.
So do you think Mitt Romney is in a better position to prevail in the debates than President Obama?
I'm not sure. President Obama, if he's prepared, will be ready to push Mitt in ways on the debate, on contradictions, how he's going to do it. But it's very difficult because as the president, you can't just act like people should know as much. You have to defend yourself to people. I think Governor Romney has done much better in debates in general than people realize. Okay, so he's a little stiff and wooden. It's not personality that matters. It's character and policies. And he's got an advantage on the economy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to Carrollton next and speak with James. Hi, James.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
What I took from what the professor said about the Democrats do one thing and the Republicans the other, what I was thinking about was like when Nixon, like the EPA and things that TR did 100 years ago, and they're more like what the Democrats would do now. And I just wondered any comment or anything about that. Just things that the Republicans had done that you'd think a Democrat would do. That's all.
That's a very wise historical point. It's amazing how much the parties shift when the South becomes Republican and changes the character of the Republican Party, and parts of New England and the West move to the Democratic Party. So you have very big differences. The socially liberal, the party of Planned Parenthood used to be Republicans, and he's certainly right about Nixon. In 1948, the Republican platform even had rent control for Dewey. Things have changed in both parties as the coalitions shift.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Larry in Dallas. Hey, Larry.
Good afternoon. Say, I want to rip the media a little bit, but the incestuous relationship between the big media and candidates and the president, that not necessarily the revolving door, but the willingness of the media to not let their questions get answered and to only ask softballs. For instance, the only question to ask Newt would have been, What is your plan for creating jobs? Is to get 5 million people a sweetheart contract with Freddie Mac? The guy, there was no there. And yet the media, what is it? The A-list for a cocktail circuit that they can't live without?
What do you think, Sam? Why are we failing?
I never thought that a question about the media being in bed with candidates would use Newt as the prime example. I agree that there are a lot of softball questions from people looking for audiences who are worried they won't get an interview if they're too tough. But I don't think much good was ever said about Newt in the media. Newt didn't need it. Newt was there as an anybody-but candidate for a while, and there's not a lot the media can do about that.
How much control do campaigns feel they can exercise over the content of media reports about their candidates?
They think they can do a lot more than they should or can do.
Mm-hmm.
The reporters are out there desperately trying to keep an audience that could have 200 channels and 85 websites and Facebook and Twitter to go to or play video games. They're fighting for an audience, and every campaign always thinks the media has got the wrong story. They're always sure they know what the story should be, and it's been there since George Washington. It's just a fact of life.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Peggy on the line next in Weatherford. Hi, Peggy.
Hi there. I had a comment and then a question as well. And my comment was that I keep hearing that the public is disappointed in President Obama, and I just wanted to say that I know a lot of people, and none of us are disappointed in President Obama. We're happy with what he's doing, and we understand the challenges that he faces. I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Okay.
And then the other thing is, I was wondering if the author believes that we get to know these candidates through the media. And as we elect them, are we electing actually, does the president matter? Are we electing a person who's going to control things, or are we actually electing his staff and his party?
What do you think, Sam?
Well, we are electing the staff and the party. And one of the good things about the long process is it makes both the staff and the party more part of the job. The president is not a monarch. The president, I think of the president as a senator with 17 votes. If the president says he'll sign a bill, 50 senators can pass it. If he says no, it takes 67. He is not God, and he is not a monarch. But the parties really matter. And so do the people that keep the president on the job and going. It's not a one-man job.
There are some campaigns, Sam, where money is no object with regard to how much campaign staffers will be earning. If they are good enough, they will raise the money and they will pay them. There are others that set salary caps. What are the reasons for each of those approaches, and how do they tend to play out?
I think the campaigns with salary caps, if you look, the ones where there's a really tight team that says we'll get to the White House and then we'll do good and then we'll do well later, like the Clinton 92, to a large extent the, I think in many ways, W in 2000, where people had to give up other jobs and only do the campaign, or Obama 2008. Those people are much more one for all and all for one than the big egos who are managing their big corporations or want to just pad their budgets.
So, in other words, you're guaranteeing that people are there because they have a passion for the candidate and for the job,
and that their reward will come after you win, not from the take they make on the campaign.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bill on the line next. He's in Fort Worth. Hey, Bill.
Good afternoon, and how are you? And thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
My comment is that how is it that when one mentioned the word stimulus, it's tied to President Obama? That's part of his legacy. That's correct. But it's not broken out as to how much was given in the stimulus package. And as you will see, if you'd ever go that far, to find out that each state got a good piece of that stimulus money, but it's never talked about. End of comment.
Thanks for your call. Well, maybe you can talk about how the Obama campaign might manage that.
Well, I think both campaigns are likely to point out who got the Obama campaign is likely to do more talk of who got help, and the Romney campaign is more likely to talk about who didn't get the help that they deserved. I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that when the campaign gets heated up.
Since you have all this experience in polling, Sam, I wonder if you can speak a little bit to how you craft questions that really allow you to figure out what voters want and what they're thinking, and the extent to which you think voters know what they want and what they're thinking.
They don't quite know what they want, but you can find out what's on their mind to some extent, and you can certainly find out what they care about. You can't say to them, what's the most important thing when you pick a president? That's like saying, why did you marry your wife? You'll get an answer, but it's hard to figure out what that had to do with who you married. Now, you can find out what they're worried about. You can find out what they like, what they don't like. And by July, we will really know the lay of the land and what's happening as the campaign floats up and down. I think this is going to be a very close election.
Do you find that coverage of elections now is focused more than it was in past years on what we always call the horse race, on the polling numbers and how voters are responding as compared with what the candidates are actually doing and saying?
You know, I think the coverage is better today.
Really?
When I did the research for my book, and I read so much sitting at one time about all the campaigns, one after the other, from 1948. I was shocked, even for the campaigns I was in, at how much richer and better the the coverage has gotten. And I don't just mean at some remote website. I mean in the, even the Associated Press, the Dallas and Houston papers, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal is so much better at coverage than it used to be, for example, of both candidates. I'm amazed at how much deeper and richer. And by the way, that makes it also much harder for the candidates.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is going into the decision-making on the Romney campaign with regard to who will be Governor Romney's running mate?
I think they all developed ulcers over gay marriage and what that's going to be. My first thought when Obama did the day, remember, after President Obama made his statement,
mm-hmm.
Governor Romney said, gay marriage is a smokescreen. Let's talk about the economy. And I almost choked on my coffee when I read that, because that's what Democrats used to say about attacks on crime or on welfare, is this is a smokescreen. Let's talk about the economy. And I realized there's going to be significant pressure in the party over what to do on religious issues.
Hmm.
President Bush had a terrible divide when he was looking at Senator Hagel and Governor Ridge, both war heroes, both extraordinary men, one pro-choice, one pro-life. He ended up with Dick Cheney. The fact that he was pro-life never made the stories because there was so much else to say about him, and he finessed it. But with former Senator Santorum, you know, going to push hard to keep his issues alive, because he knows if Romney loses, he's going to be a front runner for 2016. It's going to be very tricky how Governor Romney sticks to the civil union marriages for a man and a woman without losing more in some states than he gains in states where he doesn't need more help.
And for President Obama, we have about 30 seconds here. The biggest challenges for him?
The biggest challenge for him is to show people, if he can, that the notion that the Republicans will keep the good parts of health care while eliminating the mandate is impossible economically. It's a very tricky job to show people you can keep the pre-existing condition part of the health care while dropping the mandate. It's economically impossible, but it sounds good.
The new book by Samuel L. Popkin is called The Candidate: What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Sam, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with
us. It's a pleasure to be with somebody who read the book so carefully.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.